nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so welcome everybody, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here about non-equilibrium Green's function theory applied on transport and optical gain in terahertz quantum cascade lasers. So for those that don't know me yet, I'm a new postdoc in the group of Professor Gerhard Klimek, so in the Department of Electric and Computer Engineering. However, I think it's just fair to mention that the work that I'm going to present you has been done during my PhD thesis. So it has been done in the WSI, that is Walter Schottky Institute. This institute is part of the physics department in the Technische Universität München. So this is in Munich, the University in Munich. Or in Garching, well, this is where this institute is really placed, but this is very close to Munich. So why it is interesting to look at transport in terahertz quantum cascade lasers? Well, let me tell you, quantum cascade lasers are promising candidates for high power and coherent sources of terahertz radiation. And this terahertz radiation itself is interesting because you can use it for gas phase spectroscopy. It is valuable for telecommunications and also security applications. So, for example, those famous body scanners in the airport, I mean, in the security section of the airport, they use terahertz radiation. However, they don't use terahertz QCLs because those devices are up to now limited to cryogenic temperatures. So when you try to run them at room temperature, they just stay dark. That's the reason why we need a theory to predict and then, of course, also to optimize the terahertz quantum cascade lasers. Well, and we have done this by applying the non-equilibrium Green's function formalism. This is typically abbreviated with NEGF. We have applied this method on the stationary transport in terahertz quantum cascade lasers, including incoherent scattering on phonons, impurities, and rough interfaces. We have calculated the optical gain in linear optical response. And I think, which is most or quite remarkable, we have considered the QCLs as open quantum devices. You will later see in my talk, this is critical to show non-periodic phenomena. So what I want you to take with you after this talk, so you could say the main message is, I want to convince you that NEGF is really the method of choice to quantitatively predict and also to analyze the experimental data from the theoretical point of view. I will show you that this is so because we get energy resolved information in a consistent manner, and this information is essential in particular for optimizing quantum cascade lasers. But of course, you could also apply the same statement on almost any quantum device. And I also want to show you that non-periodic phenomena are critical for the QCL performance. What is a quantum cascade laser? A typical terahertz quantum cascade laser consists of several hundreds of periodically repeated layers. These devices utilize the transport of electrons typically in a single conduction band. So this here should just be a schematic of such a conduction band. You see we have a lot of barriers and quantum wells, and well, a quantum cascade laser consists of a basic sequence of quantum barriers and quantum wells that are repeated periodically. So you see we have a system of layers, different homogeneous semiconductor layers. They are somehow periodic. I mean, the geometry is periodic, and that's the reason why all current theoretical models of quantum cascade lasers effectively fold the electron distribution into a single QCL period in order to guarantee periodic solutions. Well, they do this in different manners. For example, I mean, in the case of NEGF, you can find a scheme to represent Green's functions in an incomplete Vanier Stark basis, which masks non-periodic wave functions. And then you can also constrain the solution space to periodic state occupancies. Well, such a scheme is very efficient if you want to treat many of those periods. However, you have the disadvantage that you will definitely miss any non-periodic effect if there is one that plays a role. Now, in our work, we did something else because we treated the QCLS open quantum devices attached to semi-infinite leads. We have implemented NEGF in a fully self-consistent manner, but it's important to say we really do not enforce or build in any periodic solutions. If you get a periodic result, this is then already a result. This is not, you could say this is a condition we apply on our solution space. But if you don't get a periodic solution, then this is also a result. Some details about what we did. We calculated electronic transport in a single non-parabolic conduction band. We took into account electron-electron interaction in the Hartree approximation. We also did some test calculations, including inelastic scattering. So we did exchange. However, I won't show you results of this because it was just meant for test cases. We have implemented incoherent scattering within the self-consistent Born approximation. So we took into account inelastic scattering on acoustic and polar optical phonons and elastic scattering on charged impurities and on rough interfaces. So what does it mean? We have an open quantum device. Well, we solve the Green's functions explicitly within a finite area of interest that is given here in blue. So this is our device. From the simulation point of view, this device is attached to semi-infinite leads, and these leads then supply electrons to the device, electrons from very large reservoirs. Very large, what does it mean? Well, when we have a difference of the chemical potentials here in these reservoirs, we apply a finite voltage, and this voltage, of course, induces a current density in our device. However, this current density is assumed to be compared to these very large reservoirs, it's assumed to be infinitesimal, which means these reservoirs remain in equilibrium. So in general, you could say transport in such an open quantum device is a scattering problem of electrons between those reservoirs, with the active device here as a scattering center. And now in the case of quantum cascade lasers, of course, these leads here do not supply electrons. They do not supply bulk electrons, but they supply electrons given in propagating eigenstates of the periodic lead Hamiltonian, which is containing the QCL geometry. How does this transport in general look like? So in order to illustrate you this, I show you here just a typical calculation, or let's say a calculation of a typical terahertz quantum cascade laser. The colored region here is this active device, where we calculate the Green's functions explicitly in. Those gray regions here, they show the first nanometers of the semi-infinite leads. So I should tell you, here is the position axis, which is the growth coordinate, and here is the electronic energy axis. And the white line now is a drawing of the conduction band profile. So here you can see those quantum barriers and quantum wells in the device as well as in the leads. The contour plot that you can see here is a contour plot of the energy and spatially resolved spectral function. So let me tell you, maxima of the spectral function correspond to resonant electronic states. Let me tell you now, those two maxima here in the center of our QCL period, this region here is now exactly one QCL period. So here in the center, we have those two maxima, represent the upper laser level. You can see these maxima are aligned with this state here. So what happens is electrons from the source, they coherently enter this upper laser level. When we have electrons in those maxima here, which represent the lower laser level, they can resonantly tunnel out of this regime, out of these two quantum wells, and enter the biggest, the widest quantum well of our period, which is termed the collector well. Well, why collector well? Because we have here those two maxima here, which are the first and the second state of this quantum well. The electrons enter the second state, and due to this energy difference here, they can resonantly emit a longitudinal optical phonon. So you could say this well here collects electrons out of the lower laser level. So you see, we have a state alignment that allows a coherent filling of the upper laser level. Electrons from the lower laser level resonantly emit LO phonons and thereby deplete the lower laser level. Let me briefly convince you that we are able to reproduce experimental results. So what I show here are IV characteristics of an experimentally fabricated gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide, QCL. Those numbers here, they just represent the structure of one period. The symbols are experimental results. So here we said we applied voltage per period. Here is the current density. Different colors correspond to different doping densities of this virus quantum well here. And now the solid lines are theoretical predictions. So you see we get quite an excellent agreement with experimental data. I mean, this is true for IV characteristics. It's also true for light frequency. When you wonder where the discrepancy here for higher voltages come from, well, let me tell you, in this voltage regime, the laser is already emitting light, and this means we have effects such as nonlinear electron-photon interaction, and also we could have, we most likely have also hot electrons, these effects are both not covered yet in this theory. Therefore, we get this discrepancy. Now, when I show you this agreement, let me tell you, this is not an argument why we have to take any GF, because you could apply, for example, the ensemble Monte Carlo method, which is numerically much easier to apply, and you still can reproduce IV characteristics. So what I'm going to show you in the rest of the talk is why the non-equilibrium Green's function has been applied in our case here, and why this is a good idea. Before I do this, I have to tell you at least some basics about NEGF. So when we solve the non-equilibrium Green's function formalism in a stationary situation, we need two functions. The first one is a retarded Green's function. So here's just a Dyson equation of this retarded Green's function. When you're not familiar with this formalism, let me just tell you, here we have the one particle Hamiltonian, here is the Hartree potential, here we have so-called scattering self energy. So they care about incoherent scattering, and this is just the electronic energy. So what you have here is basically the Schrödinger equation. And that's the reason why this retarded Green's function contains information about electronic states. So in the case of a simple quantum well, the retarded Green's function tells us where in energy the resonant states lie. I mean, what are the resonant energies, and also what the lifetime of these states are. Lifetimes. That's why I put here circles or something, not lines. The second Green's function now is the so-called lesser than Green's function, which contains information about the occupancy of these states. So when we want to know how are those states filled, then we need G lesser. Now, the strength of the NEGF formalism is we can calculate the occupancy of these resonant states as well as the electronic states in a self-consistent manner. And that means, we get a consistent calculation of resonant states and the state occupancies, and this allows us to determine reliable energy-resolved information, which I will show you later is vital for device analysis. So when we have GR and G lesser, we can calculate observables such as the electron density and the current density. I told you we could do this with many methods. However, since we do here a consistent calculation of state occupancy and resonant states, we could, for example, take this definition or the formula for the electron density and just ignore the energy integral. And this gives us a kind of energy resolved density. So now in the next slides, I want to show you why this energy resolved information is very valuable. Very important. So what you see here is just another IV characteristic of this terahertz quantum cascade laser. So here's applied bias voltage per period. Here's the current density through the total device. Again, those dots here are experimental results. The black solid line is, again, a full NEGF calculation. Now, the green line here is something new we haven't seen yet. This is just a ballistic calculation. So we have calculated just the same device, but we have turned off any incoherent scattering mechanism. So you can see here from this comparison, obviously incoherent scattering increases the stationary current in these terahertz quantum cascade lasers, But what was surprising for us and also for the experimentalists, that was that when you look at the threshold voltage, which is marked here by the gray line, and you look at the relative contribution to the threshold current, the relative contribution of coherent tunneling and incoherent sketching, we have seen that almost two-thirds of the transport is carried by coherent tunneling. And well, this was amazing because these devices, I told you before, these devices, in particular at the threshold voltage, they rely on the resonant emission of LO phonons. So the question came up, yeah, why is this incoherent sketching, why does it contribute so little to the current? Because after all, you know, we have to emit one LO phonon when we want to pass one QCL period. In order to answer this question, we need this energy resolve information. So what I show you here is again this spectral function. So here is this, of the same terahertz quantum cascadizer. So here is again position axis, here is electronic energy axis. The white line is again a drawing of the conduction band profile. And since it's some minutes ago, let me tell you again, maxima of this spectral function correspond to resonant states. So you have seen before, we have the upper laser level here. This gets electrons in the upper laser can tunnel resonantly into the upper laser level because this state is aligned with the upper laser level. And just let me remind you, we have electrons in the lower laser level. They are supposed to resonantly tunnel out of this upper lower laser level, and here they should emit a longitudinal optical phonon. So we have a resonant filling, a resonant depletion, both in the aspect of coherent tunneling and resonant emission of LO phonons. The problem here now is you can see those two tiny maxima here. They are aligned at the energy of the upper laser level. And these maxima now really allow a coherent leakage out of electrons out of the upper laser level. So from this result, we can now really judge this device. We can say, okay, we have a proper level alignment to allow resonant filling and depletion of the laser levels. However, okay, I haven't mentioned this yet. When you look at the distance of those two maxima, I mean, here are the tick labels here, the ticks. You can see we have a distance more than 40 millielectron volts. This device is mainly a gallium arsenide device. So the energy of an LO phonon is 36 millielectron volts, not 40. So we do not really match the resonant emission condition here. And I told you we have these maxima here. They allow for a significant leakage current. Yeah, and that's basically the reason why coherent tunneling and coherent multivariate tunneling is important for this device. Well, this is undesirable. So we also thought, how can we improve this device? How can we optimize it? So we thought we have to get rid of those tiny two maxima here. Well, we have seen that these, I mean, we have shown this. I haven't shown you yet, but let me just tell you, these tiny two maxima here, they are generated by a small anti-crossing of the second state of this collector well with the upper laser level. So we thought, okay, when we can push down the second state here in energy, we can suppress this anti-crossing. So what we just did is we took the original design of the terahertz QCL and broadened this collector well. So we just increased it by 1.8 nanometers. And then here you can see the result at the same bias. Indeed, we have shifted down the second state and we have successfully suppressed these small resonances. What happens then with the IV characteristics? So here is the original result with two-thirds of the threshold current carried by coherent tunneling. Here is now the prediction of the new design. And you can see here at threshold, we have even flipped the relative contribution to the threshold current. So you can see here, I've shown you the QCL performance is predictable with the retarded Green's function, and it's also understandable. There is still the second Green's function, and I haven't talked about this yet. In order to motivate this, I want to present you a question that came to our mind. So when you take a typical resonant phonon quantum cascade laser, so that the quantum cascade laser I've just shown you before, then such a laser is designed that the voltage drop near the threshold voltage is, let's say, 54 millielectron volts. I mean, this is not an arbitrary number. This is quite close to reality. Now, when the electrons behave in the way the experimentalists have meant them to behave, then they propagate through a single Q-cell period and emit exactly one LO phonon. So this means they dissipate 36 millielectron volts, and there's a remaining energy of 18 millielectron volts. Originally, these electrons are supposed to also emit one photon per period. Unfortunately, the photon emission is by far too inefficient in state-of-the-art terahertz QCLs. Actually, I had some discussions with experimentalists, and they believe it's only maybe one photon per 50 periods or something. So this is far from being reality that we really emit one photon per period. We have also tried other scattering mechanisms. So we have included these acoustic phonons. We have also checked inelastic electron-electron scattering. However, acoustic phonons are just the scattering with them is too inefficient to really dissipate such a large amount of energy. And, well, the doping density of those lasers is by far too weak to have an efficient inelastic electron-electron scattering. So we wondered, where does this remaining energy go to, and is the electron distribution really periodic? Let me show you that the retarded Green's function cannot answer this question. So what I show you here is now a calculation of two adjacent QCL periods of the device I've just discussed before. So here's again position axis, here's electronic energy axis, white line is again the conduction band profile. Here we have the first QCL period, here we have the second period, and the contour plot here is again a contour plot of the spectral function. Now when you compare the resonance states in, for example, here the laser levels in the left and the right period, I hope you can see they are very similar. When you can do a more detailed analysis, but it will show you that the density of states in two adjacent QCL periods is indeed periodic. Well, that's the reason, or at least later on you will see, why GR doesn't really answer every question. Why is this so? Because you will see now that the current density and the state occupation are both indeed non-periodic. So what I show you here now is a calculation of, a single QCL period of the same device. So here's the position axis, here's energy axis, again, conduction band profile. But now this contour here shows you the energy in spatially resolved current density. Well, we do stationary calculations. I have to tell you what does it mean, energy resolved current density. When you integrate this function here at a specific device position over energy, so over energy E here, then you get a local current density. Okay, we do the stationary calculations. So this local current density, well, it's constant in space. Nevertheless, maxima of this energy resolved current elucidates propagating charge carriers. So here we can see we have a large number of electrons that just propagate from the left end to the right end of the QCL period without changing energy. So they don't dissipate energy. Only here in the collector well, some of them will lose energy, they fall down in energy, and this distance here is now exactly one LO phonon energy. So here you can see the onset of emission of LO phonons. What happens with our energy balance? In order to show you this, or to illustrate this, I show you here with those black lines the resonant energies of the lowest state in the leftmost and in the rightmost quantum well. When the total energy of the electrons coincides with this resonance energy, then those electrons have almost no vanishing for the in-plane momentum. Just remember, we have here homogeneous layers, so those electrons can also propagate perpendicular to our point of view. So these incoming electrons have a thermal distribution with the in-plane momentum, but when they leave the device here in this state, their total energy exceeds this resonance energy, and it exceeds it by exactly 18 millielectron volts. So this means those electrons here, they are heated up with respect to the in-plane distribution. So we can see, from this result here, that the coherent multi-barrier tunneling in connection with the emission of just one LO phonon significantly heats up the carrier distribution. So this is obviously a non-periodic result. Here we have a different result on the boundary than here. What happens now with those heated electrons? So what I show here is again the same QCL, but now we have again two adjacent QCL periods explicitly calculated. So here is the first and here is the second period. This is again the energy resolved current density. So here you see this efficient multi-barrier tunneling. Those electrons here in the collector well of the first period, they emit the first LO phonon. Then those heated electrons, they continue a coherent or at least dissipationless propagation until they reach the center of the second period where our laser levels are located. And here they emit a second LO phonon and here then a third LO phonon. So in the sum, you can see these electrons emit three longitudinal optical phonons when they propagate through two QCL periods. How can this be? Well, when you look at the energy balance, those electrons accumulate or they propagate through a potential drop of 108 millielectron volts. And this is exactly the energy of three longitudinal optical phonons. I hope it's clear that when we change this bias voltage, then also this periodicity changes. And we can even think of incommensurable periodicities between, the electronic periodicity and the QCL geometry. This result is problematic, in particular because of the emission of the second LO phonon. I told you those electrons here are on the upper laser level, and they end up in the lower laser level. So this emission here reduces the occupation inversion, and to give you numbers, we have seen that the occupation inversion in the second period is 60% lower than in the first period. So you could say, hand waving or something, you could at least say almost every second QCL period remains dark. It doesn't emit light. Of course, this is highly non-desirable, so how can we improve it, this design? How can we restore the QCL periodicity? In order to do this, we took the original QCL design, which is given here in the gray shaded region, and we have augmented it by one additional quantum well. The purpose of this quantum well was twofold. First, it should suppress the coherent leakage current. So what you see here, we still have a coherent tunneling, but those electrons cannot reach the right end, the source end of our period. And the second purpose was it should allow for a second resonant emission of an LO phonon. So this is what you can see here. Here's the first LO phonon emitted and here the second one. Now the width of this quantum well is chosen such that the voltage at threshold, the potential drop at threshold voltage is commensurable with the energy of the LO phonons. So here we have just 72, which is exactly twice 36. So in this way, we can guarantee that at threshold voltage, the electrons are thermalized within each period. You can see this here. Here are again the resonant energies of the lowest lying states. So here still we have heated electrons, but then they get thermalized. Since they are thermalized, we can guarantee that non-radiative transitions in subsequent periods are suppressed. And of course, we pin the electrons to the QCL geometry, which should stabilize electrostatics. Let me come to my conclusion. So I've shown you our implementation of a fully self-consistent non-equilibrium Green's function formalism for quantum cascade lasers. We have taken into account quantum mechanical many body effects and all relevant incoherent sketching mechanisms. We have calculated the optical gain in linear response. Our results show a very good agreement of the calculated AV characteristics and the optical gain with experiment. I hope I have convinced you that the full information given by a consistent NEGF calculation is vital for a thorough device analysis. And I think this is at least one of the most important strengths of NEGF, because this information is, well, inaccessible or at least very difficult to access by experiments and many other theoretical models. And maybe you're also convinced that non-periodic effects limit the performance of state-of-the-art quantum cascade lasers. Thank you for your attention. The grid spacing in most of these devices was 0.9 nanometers. So it's a homogeneous grid. Of course, this is not the best solution. At least it worked.
And you used the finite differences?
Finite differences, yes.
Did you ever try to do something?
No. I mean, since finite differences worked, I mean, I hadn't any problems. Maybe it's also due to the relative small doping here, so the Poisson equation doesn't really play a significant role. I can imagine that when you have high doping density and the conduction band profile gets distorted a lot, then it might change. Just look at these conduction band profiles. They are almost linear. You really have to put a ruler on it, and then you will see there are changes, but it's almost linear.
So the term linear accounts for the linearity of the bands, or it accounts for the distribution of the
bands? Maybe I should say something about the boundary conditions in this case. You see, when you solve the Poisson equation with Neumann boundary conditions, but with a finite slope at the edges, at the boundaries of your device, and your device is almost empty, though there are hardly any electrons or also hardly any positive charges, then you will just get a linear curve. So, okay, of course, when we have some nonlinear energies, then just because, for example, here there could be many electrons trapped, so we have a kind of charge accumulation, and then you get a small repulsive potential here. Those devices, well, they are the highest doped experimental devices. Just see the very first band bending in a small shift of the resonance states. Yeah. Do you want to organize? Who is next? Michael?
Okay, why do you say that actually one should do next? Okay, you see, I understand actually that actually we need a quantum model.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To have a self-consistent model with all effects. Why next?
Because of this energy resolve data. What you can do, for example, in ensemble Monte Carlo, which means you solve the Schrödinger equation, you have your resonance states, and then you determine the occupancy of those states using Monte Carlo. You can also produce those graphs here, but you have to apply a model. What is the actual width of those states? Of course, you could say you have an effective scattering rate. You have it in Monte Carlo, and then you can just say, okay, well, I assume we have a Lorentzian or Gaussian shape of those states here in energy, and it has a width corresponding to this scattering rate. But you don't get it self-consistently. Yeah, you have to apply another model. You can do density metrics. But usually you also integrate, to my knowledge at least, you integrate there already over energy. When you don't do it, then you do NEGF.
Okay, I don't actually
So let me answer maybe then to a final answer, so to say. Of course, there's no need really to do NEGF. When you have a consistent model that can calculate lifetime, the resonant energies, and the occupancy, then you could do the same here. Sure.
In principle, yeah. It is possible to do numerically, but in principle.
I'm sure you will end up with the same numerical problems you have in NEGF. It should cost you the same amount of computer, even more probably.
So I have two questions. So one is what is the actual extent of the contacts when you solve the Poisson equation for charge neutrality?
Okay. Maybe you have seen those graphs. Maybe I should go to the beginning. No? Okay. So, to be honest, I mean, I didn't say the complete truth here. The actual QCL period goes from the center of this barrier to the center of this barrier. But what you have to do is you have to calculate, I mean, at least in the way I've implemented NGF, you have to calculate also a small fraction of the next period. And you solve, well, the complete Green's function formalism there. So including Poisson equation, including scattering and everything else.
So your Poisson equation is a 1D Poisson equation?
Yes. I mean, it depends just on the density, and the density depends on just one spatial coordinate.
And another question is, like, as Michael pointed out, like, can you do, you said that you can also do this thing with using Monte Carlo simulation.
Yes, we have also done comparisons, by the way.
My question is, like, I don't know exactly, like, Monte Carlo, I believe, like, many times it depends on the relaxation time approximation.
So sure.
How valid is that approximation in this particular region, like, or in this picture, like?
You mean the Monte Carlo? I wouldn't go into this detail. I mean, considering about relaxation time approximation, I think you already face a problem in Monte Carlo, at least in the methods that I'm aware of. You have to solve the Schrödinger equation, and you get eigenfunctions, which means they have an infinite lifetime. This gives you numerical problems. Whenever you have anti-crossing, you suddenly have a delocalized state that extends over your total period. This increases the current tremendously. So what the people get is they call it, I think, parasitic current channels or something. I mean, they have big spikes in their IV characteristics, which are obviously numerically artifacts. Of course, you can care about how to calculate the scattering lifetimes, but I think Fermi's golden rule is still applicable. The scattering here is not that big. Okay.
So it's not big, because relaxation time approximation has this assumption like each scattering is independent of what happened in the past. So
yeah.
What exactly happened in the past.
Sure.
So you start from an equilibrium distribution of
charges and then you again scatter. Okay. We don't have, I mean, it's a Markovian problem that you're speaking of. I mean, this doesn't apply here, as I told you. The scattering, I mean, you can consider the scattering events to happen independently from each other. Sure. Okay. Or maybe you?
Yeah. You have used a steady state energy formalism.
Yeah.
How do you extract the terahertz property?
Okay. Good question, yeah. This is linear response, as I told you. So what we assume is, we assume the electric field, electrodynamic field of the photon as a small perturbation. That is a frequency-dependent perturbation. And this gives us changes of the Green's functions, which gives changes of the current density or the conductivity, you could say, and then you can do simple electrodynamics. Because you have a complex susceptibility. So the major point is just to say the photon does only a small perturbation. This is the starting point. So it's still static, stationary. So it's still a stationary problem.
The width of this area or this quantum well,
yeah,
I can see it's in the order of 5 or 6 nanometers.
The smallest ones are 2.7 or something.
So I'm just thinking from an experimental view. I mean, if it is a diffuse interface, I mean, if it's not that far enough,
sure.
How would your
this is included. We have rough interfaces. So the fact that you don't have in the experiment, you don't have such a definite position of your interface. This is included in terms of scattering self-energies. So, part of this lifetime here, of the width of these states, comes from this uncertainty.
Coming back to the numerics, how do you manage all those resonances in the density of states?
You mean how to resolve them? Well, we have to iterate a lot. In any case, whatever you do with the energy grid. So you have to iterate because the Green's function formalism is a nonlinear one. And we can use these iterations to adjust the energy grid. So we start with an initial guess that is just homogeneous and search for the first resonances that we can see. Those are, at the beginning, they are badly resolved. But we know where they are and we can refine our grid at their positions. This is how it works. So, Yeah, exactly.
So, actually, in principle, you can miss, actually.
Sure, of course. We have to check that when we adapt another energy grid, we should get the same result. Convergency is, in such an iterative scheme, a big issue. This has to be ensured, no doubt. But you know, you can look at this result and just count how many states do I have and how many states do I have to have. Yeah, I mean, for example, it's quite easy when you get used to this. These two quantum wells here, when you separate them in this energy scale, they have just the first state. So you expect one of those states for each quantum well. When you bring them close together, they are interacting, so they're anti-crossing. So this means you have still two states, but they get connected. And you have here a bonding state and here an antibonding state. When you look close here you have, in this gap, you have no density of states, and here you have a density of states. So this is still a kind of bonding and antibonding symmetry. It gets, perturbed by the interaction of this bonding state with the next state. But there is no doubt, this is why the splitting here comes from, because here you also have a bonding and an antibonding symmetry. But there is no doubt that there is no state missing in between, because still we have started with two states.
Are you able to simulate the structure when you turn off the self energies?
Yes. I mean, it cannot turn off every self energy. I mean, I have done this, you know, this was a ballistic calculation, because I still have the boundaries.
Yeah, but apart from the boundary.
Apart from the boundary, of course, I have done so. So these...
Because what happens is you lose the broadening?
No, not completely, that's the point. So this green curve here, this is exactly what you say. This is where I have turned off incoherent sketching completely. But still I have a finite lifetime from a numerical point of view, because the electrons in the device can decay into the leads. Of course, when you confine them completely in a deep quantum well, then I can't find them. That's clear. Exactly. But this happens. No? Here. I mean, this happens automatically. At least this state here couples to the source, to the drain. This is sufficient. Maybe the one in the back, because I think.
What method are you using for the fix? Are you approximating or?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I use a self-consistent Born approximation.
Okay.
Sure.
Is your Hamiltonian and Milliwatt Hamiltonian or not?
The original, yes. So when I just set up all my equations, then I have a complete many-body problem. Mm-hmm. However, I do an interaction, do a transformation into an interaction picture, and then I expand the unitary operator that gives me this transformation. But in general, the original problem is a full many-body problem, yes. Yeah, you could say the ordinary NEGF that is numerically implemented just cares about one-particle Green's functions. So, of course, you have to break down your full theory into this scheme. But, I mean, as I told you, those calculations are done at 40 Kelvin lattice temperature. So you don't have that large amount of phonons and impurities, also not because you don't have such a big doping. So this is, I would say, this is okay in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.